Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 13th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Finding Faith in the Wilderness, Adventures in the Book of Exodus, Finding Freedom in the Wilderness. Presented by Bob Ekblad. The tape number is EKB 2002-07. Let's listen in.
Welcome to our second Bible study on finding faith in the wilderness. I'm Bob Ekblad, and I'm director of a ministry to migrant farm workers and chaplain of a jail, for those of you that don't already know that. And we have a program that we just started called the People Seminary, where we train congregations, pastors, and seminarians in skills of reading scripture with people on the margins. So I'm used to a lot of my Bible studies that I do. I do two Bible studies a week, and I've been working through Exodus for a long time, for many years actually, with inmates. I do every Thursday night and every Sunday I have a Bible study with anywhere from 10 to 25 men in the red jail fatigues. We get in a big circle and we've read through all of the Gospels and much of the Old Testament over the years, over the 8 years that I've been doing this. So some of my perspectives have come out of that, and I've actually learned so much from the inmates. I mean, I've learned more from my brothers and sisters in the jail than I ever learned in seminary, that's for sure. And so I often go and I say, hey, teach me what you think this means, because my life's easy compared to yours. And they're able to come up with a lot. So anyway, I'd like to invite you, though, to ponder a text that is a difficult text. It's today's session is called Finding Freedom in the Wilderness. Entering into true wilderness requires nothing less than a miracle. So what we're going to look at is Exodus 14 as a description of how people make the break from the old to the new. I'd like to invite you to turn to Exodus 13, 17. Now, this is a very difficult text, I find, anyway. Kept me up half the night last night with all of its kind of complexities. And, you know, some of the difficulties are God's hardening of the Pharaoh's heart. And, you know, what do you make of that? Or even worse, God's killing of the firstborn Egyptians. And then these miraculous stories. You know, I mean, the story of the sea opening up and the people walking in on dry land, and then the nonviolent God wiping them all out and drowning every single Egyptian. Right? I mean, there's just a lot of blood and gore and things that are difficult to believe in this story. And so I've struggled with it to determine, well, really, what is it about? And I think many of our struggles come from reading it too much in a literal, overly historicized way. And so I want to introduce you to a more of a theological read of this text, where we look at what is it saying about God and about the human condition. There's several questions that I think this story answers or speaks to.
What scripture did you say? Exodus what?
14? Exodus chapter 13.
Oh, 13. Okay.
Verses 17. I mean, we're jumping way ahead in Exodus. Since this is the wilderness is the theme, you know, we have to kind of move all the way through the plagues without even saying a word about them, hardly, and move right to the entrance of the people, the departure of the people from the land of Egypt, from slavery into the wilderness. And yesterday's Bible study, how many of you were present yesterday? Okay, yesterday we noticed that in chapter 3, verse 1, Moses drove his flock behind the wilderness, okay, to the mountain of God, to Horeb, the mountain of God. And we talked about how the wilderness is a metaphor for, it's a place, earlier in the scripture, it's a place where people are driven, who are castaways, you know, like Hagar is, or either that or a place where people flee to because they're being pursued. Okay, so one example would be Hagar, who flees away from her mistress Sarai, who's abusing her. Okay, and another example, an example of someone who is driven there is Hagar once again, who later, after she has Ishmael, is driven there, driven away by Sarai and Abraham. And it's also a place where people are exiled in a way. I mean, Joseph was thrown into a pit in the wilderness. Okay, so but a wilderness is also a place where people are met by God, where people are found by God. Hagar is found by the well, in the desert, and God gives her a promise. And Hagar and Ishmael are also, God hears her cry and delivers Ishmael and Hagar, and gives them the promise. And of course, Joseph is also delivered in sort of a weird, paradoxical way. I mean, he's sold into slavery, you know, which leads to the people actually all going into Egypt. But it also, it saves the people on the one hand, because they went there because of famine, but it's also the place now where the people find themselves having to struggle with this question of who is our God? Is our God Pharaoh, or is our God Adonai, or the Lord? So I think this story really is about who reigns. Is it Pharaoh who reigns, or is it the Lord? And, you know, who reigns over you? To whom do you give your allegiance? And this is one of the primary questions, I think, that Exodus is dealing with. The other question it's dealing with is a story about liberation. It's about a story about salvation, liberation, and how it happens. How do we move from a place where we are dominated over, you know, where we are experiencing oppression, to a place of freedom? You know, how does that take place, that movement, you know, from the old life to the new life, from slavery to liberation? What is, does it happen through the oppressor? I mean, one of the big questions that Americans, we always deal with in an overly facile way, I think, is we have a very positive view of our ability to bring about change, to change the minds and the hearts of our leaders. We think that we live in a democracy. We have a very high positive view of the possibility of reform. You know, reform, we believe, can happen. And I'm not saying it can't completely, but Exodus has a particular theology of the powers. And so one of the questions is, does it happen? Does liberation happen through the oppressor, through the enslaver? Another question it asks is, does liberation happen through the people's faith, through their choice? You know, another cult in America is the cult of free will. You know, it's all about, you know, we have to, what choice are you going to make? You know, are you going to choose freedom? Are you going to choose slavery? And it's all up to you. Okay, we have, Americans are really high on that. Okay, so Exodus, I think, speaks to us directly, and by offering some answers to these questions about whether the powers can change and can liberate, actually, and whether people can actually have the power, the willpower, whatever it takes to find liberation. And so anyway, I think the answer to this question is that it's God who saves. Okay, but let's look at the story. I'd like us to read. If someone could read loud and slowly from the NRSV version, I'd like us to read the first section, which is Exodus 13:17 through 14:9.
When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of land of the Philistines, although that was nearer, for God thought, if the people face war, they may change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people by the roundabout way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of the land of Egypt, prepared for battle. And Moses took with him the bones of Joseph, who had required a solemn oath of the Israelites, saying, God will surely take notice of you. And then you must carry my bones with you from here. Continue?
Yeah, keep going all the way to, let's see, verse 9, 14, verse 9.
Oh, okay. They set out from Succoth and camped at Ephah on the edge of the wilderness. The Lord went in front of them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them along the way, and in the pillar of fire by night to give them light, so that they might travel by day and by night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. Then the Lord said to Moses.
Actually, why don't you stop right there? Thank you. Let's say a few things about just these verses. We're given a first indicator, or a first answer to our question is, how does liberation happen? With the very first word, the first few words of verse 17, okay? How does liberation happen according to that first little phrase of verse 17?
The process.
Okay, here it says, now when Pharaoh let the people go. Okay? So this is suggesting that Pharaoh actually is the one who was the savior or was the liberator figure. I mean, actually Pharaoh was brought to a point of being able to do this, to let the people go. But it remains to be seen whether that's actually the case, whether the principalities, whether the empire is able to do that. Okay, but at this point, Pharaoh has done it. Why? I'll refresh your memory. We just had 10 plagues. These were directed at Pharaoh to try to get Pharaoh, compel Pharaoh to listen to the word of the Lord, which was, let my people go. We have a constant contest going on in Exodus between Pharaoh, who claims to control and possess the people, and Moses, who's a representative of God, who says, no, hey, they're not your people. They're the Lord's people. They're my people. Let my people go. Okay, and Pharaoh is constantly hardening his heart, and even when the plagues come, Pharaoh backtracks and goes back on his word and seems incapable of releasing the people. And finally God, the ultimate, final, last straw is when God strikes the Egyptians, their firstborn. And then the people drive out, okay? They drive out. They send away the Israelites, like in a hurry, right? And that happens on the eve of the Passover, okay? So how is it that God begins this process of leading the people? What do we know just from this story so far?
Just thinking the part where he says that he took them a roundabout way because he didn't think they could handle the war.
Mm-hmm.
So God didn't give them more than they could handle.
Okay, good. So God is aware that these are folks that maybe don't quite have a faith. I mean, they're fairly fragile and vulnerable. So God takes them a roundabout way so that they avoid the temptation to return immediately to Egypt. Okay, what else do we know?
And God uses the powers that be to accomplish His purposes.
God gives us the powers?
God uses the powers that be to accomplish His purposes.
Okay, in this case, Pharaoh let the people go. Okay. What about the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire?
Visible presence.
Okay, so we have some sort of mysterious, some sort of presence behind them and before them that they're living in. They're living in a certain sort of presence that's guiding them, right, in this roundabout way out of Egypt. So here we have Egypt and we have the wilderness right here. And then we have the promise, right, of the promised land. So here we are. This story is all about the departure, okay? Let's look at the next section now. Could someone read verses chapter 14, verses 1 to 9?
Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and camp in front of Harareth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon. You shall camp opposite it by the sea. Pharaoh will say of the Israelites, they are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has closed in on them. I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, so that I will gain glory for myself over Pharaoh and all his army. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, and they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the minds of Pharaoh and his officials were changed toward the people, and they said, what have we done, letting Israel leave our service? So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 picked chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh and put them king of Egypt, and he pursued the Israelites who were going out boldly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, his chariot drivers and his army. They overtook them camped by the sea in Paharath in front of Baal Zephon.
Okay. So here we have a statement about the nature of the powers, okay, of domination, the forces of domination. This Exodus presents them as aggressive forces that pursue those who have served them. Okay, these are forces that don't just passively kind of give up, but are actually aggressive and in hot pursuit in the story. So, Egypt, the land of Egypt, I'd like to move now and try to look at contemporary equivalents of the land of Egypt. You know, for the Israelites, Egypt was the land of their enslavement, okay? And Egypt was governed by, you know, Pharaoh. And the other characters that we see later in the story, or actually right in this story, are who? Who else is mentioned in these last verses, verses 1 to 9, that are part of Pharaoh's...
His officials.
His officials, okay? The people? Did you say people? The Egyptians? And then later, when the pursuit gets really hot, we also have horsemen, chariots, army. Okay, so we have lots of language describing the forces that occupy the land and that enslave the people. And we're told now that as the people leave, these forces are pursuing them. They're in hot pursuit. And in fact, God is not worried about that because God has just, the Philistines are here, and here's the sea. And God has taken the people some roundabout way to avoid a certain immediate, another power that would have demoralized them. But yet God's put them right in a position where they're like an easy prey and they're a target for the pursuing powers, okay, of all these forces of domination that are just in hot pursuit. So God is not about just, kind of running away, run away. But it's about absolute confrontation with the powers and principalities. Okay? So tell me, what do you think of, what's the equivalent of Egypt today? What is the land of Egypt? Where is the land of Egypt?
I certainly think the United States and its government and its armies and its war-making capacity.
Okay. So if we think about USA as the land of Egypt and, you know, our armies, our government, That's one equivalent. And see, there's ways of looking for equivalents at a macro level and also a micro level. I mean, at a global level, like a world level, and also like a smaller level. I mean, you can look at these equivalents in terms of all the way down, or, you know, from the bottom up.
What about gang lords and...
Okay, so gang turf. The land of Egypt might be like the turf for some gang, I mean, their neighborhood or whatever, their barrio. Okay. The land of Egypt might be a prison. Okay, I mean, I deal with lots of people in prison who write me all the time, and it sounds like the land of Egypt to me. I mean,
especially when you consider that sometimes they want to go back because it seems easier to just go back and be in jail than just live in the world of pain.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's talk about location first, and then we're going to talk about these other players, okay? I mean, we have the land of Egypt on the one hand, but we have all this incredible, you know, there's a lot of detail in this story that invites
a detailed
comparison. Uh-huh.
Culture can just be Egypt, too. The culture has certain set of standards. Whatever culture that is, that could be the culture you're born into.
Consumerism.
Even other cultures besides ours. If you're born into Chinese culture.
Okay, so the dominant culture, you know, and that could be the American culture, that could be... You know, some traditional Chinese culture. I mean, it could be like the Honduran campesinos that I worked with. They were afraid to not slash and burn because that's what their forefathers had all done. And so to break with that and to plant to the curve of the land was like very difficult.
Multinationals.
Yeah. Multinationals. Okay, now we're moving into these other characters. Okay, but let's go there. That's fine.
In that scheme, however, you could say that the Philistines then would represent an entirely different culture, perhaps like Iraq, which is seen as enemies of both sides.
Okay, let's go here a little. Let's talk about Pharaoh officials, the Egyptians, the horsemen, the chariots, the army. What might some of those forces be that occupy? I mean, that hold us in the land of Egypt and that keep us from leaving. I mean, that are in hot pursuit. What are some of the forces that are pursuing you?
You know, going back to that and kind of tying it in, anything that puts somebody in bondage or in control, something is in control of them, puts you in slavery and bondage,
sure.
Whether it's your thought life or drugs or fear or whether it's a person who's obsessed with anything, and that to me is a land of bondage. It's a personal hell for someone.
Sure.
And when you put yourself in bondage or you get controlled by a force, that person becomes enslaved. And that can be from culture and choice and all sorts of things that, you know, you get caught when you're just trying to have fun or something. But, you know, and all those things control.
Okay, let's name some names. Let's get down to business here. What are some of the forces that are pursuing us?
Money.
Okay, money.
Television.
Poverty. What did you say?
Poverty.
Poverty.
Lust.
Sexuality.
Greed.
Achievement. Yeah, success.
Work. Power.
Boy, you guys are good.
Consumption.
Would you know? Exodus has an image of these forces as pursuing us, okay? As separate from us. And this is really critical to note, the complexity of which this story. I mean, the complexity, it allows a pretty fairly complex analysis when you look at all of the, just all the detail of the narrative itself. You know, when you start looking, transposing and saying, okay, well, what is the equivalent today? I mean, there's a myriads of equivalents today, right? I mean, you can look at this this could be the person that's pursuing, could be a dominating husband, you know, like a batterer. I mean, we deal with lots of women who come to our family support center who are just on the run. You know, and they're being pursued, and their partners know how to look, you know, and they're desperate, and they're scary, you know, they're violent, and it's extremely difficult. So, I mean, this could be a bad earth.
What about illness?
Illness, okay. You know, you think about people that are struggling with cancer or with HIV, AIDS, any disease that is growing, that is
Alzheimer's,
that is progressing to take you over, you know, that's after you. Anger. Okay. Now this image of sin as something separate from human beings and as something that is in pursuit is a very biblical image. And it's not time to really go into detail, but let me give you a few examples. Think about Cain and Abel. Remember Genesis chapter 4, when Cain becomes angered. It says he's angered when God chooses Abel. Abel's sacrifice over Cain's. And then God says, Cain, why are you angry? You know, then he goes on and says, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire, you know, its desire, the word desire there is sensual, sexual sort of passion. And its desire, it loves you, it's in love with you. You know, and in that case, it's anger. And anger is in love with you. And of course, you know, anger is something that's very seductive, right? Yeah. It's like when you get angry, boy, it's a head rush. And you know, a lot of people that I work with, well, myself included, I mean, any of you have experienced anger. When you're angry, there's something, there's
it's
power.
Empowering.
It's empowering, okay? Yeah. So it's a love affair you can have with anger, right? But it's in pursuit of you, God says to Cain. You know, but you can master over it, God says, right? Okay? And, well, anyway, anger. And the early church fathers, the Greek fathers, which most of us in Western Christianity are unfamiliar with, they have a whole description of this, of sin, in terms of the eight mortal passions. The Western Church calls that the seven deadly sins. So we have a totally different notion of sin, more as a trespass, like a crime that deserves either punishment or forgiveness. But the Eastern Church sees sin as sickness, and that requires healing. Okay? So anger is seen as an illness that advances and that is in pursuit, as is lust and greed and gluttony and, you know, all the passions, okay? So they're really good at talking about all the passions and going into incredible detail and talking about how they pursue us and how we need to resist. But there's a whole nother whole body of language in the Bible that is called, that in the New Testament are described as principalities and powers, okay? So here we have a big list of things where we're mixing together principalities and powers, which would be more like things like, well, drugs, money. We haven't really gone into some of the institutional forces that are pursuing us. You know, let's go there for a second. What are some of the institutions that the names? Let's name some names. Who is in pursuit of you?
Government.
Okay. And here we get into some of the powers and principalities that are more structures.
Media.
Okay, we talked about media, I think.
TV.
Maybe not.
TV.
Nintendo.
Nintendo. Okay. And what about you,
Jonathan?
How
about our employers?
What's that?
How about our employers? I mean,
employers.
Sometimes you're really stuck.
Okay. Jonathan was actually yesterday we had two presentations that just left me just kind of in turmoil yesterday. One was on the international sex trade, you know, the prostitution trade. Oh, just such a bleak, complex picture, right? Where all sorts of forces are, you know, individuals and groups and, you know, the syndicates that are involved in this trafficking of people, right? Mm-hmm. From different countries to the United States. And then right after that, I went to Jonathan's talk. I had dinner, and then I went to Jonathan's talk and heard about Afghanistan, you know, that has just gone through this incredible, I don't know how many, 20, 30 years of war, warlords fighting warlords, and poor people just being caught in this horrible place and being impoverished, just the grinding poverty of Afghanistan, overwhelming. So, you know, when you think globally about these forces, there's lots more names to be named. Okay, what are some of those names?
Can I just add one on the Nintendo real quick?
Yeah.
What about hip hop music?
Okay, hip hop music.
Yes.
Hip hop music. Does it pursue you?
Yeah. Certain lyrics.
Subliminals have an effect on my thinking.
That's really true.
It does. It has an effect on my spiritual growth.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
What about cocaine? You know, a lot of people I work with, you know, coke, crack. You know, people talk about coke as being like this seductive being that comes and it just whispers in their ears, and just caresses them, and it just pulls them back into its grasp. Okay, I mean, it's cocaine, heroin. I mean, these are spiritual forces, right? I mean, people experience them.
You better put alcohol.
Heroin, okay.
Prostitution.
How about addiction?
Okay, prostitution.
Pornography.
I mean, prostitution, you have to even, there's a complex web there of all kinds of pleasures, right?
Yeah.
Okay, one thing to realize that here we have Pharaoh and officials, the Egyptians, the horsemen, the chariots, but then on the other hand, we have the people, the Israelites.
That's right.
So, you know, who are the Israelites?
What we were talking about tonight, these Israelites, it was interesting that the original people that came to Egypt, it had been generations. These were generations down the way who had worked as knowledgeable and as strict in their religion as the original people that were captured. So, and then they put them in the wilderness. They don't know anything about living in the wilderness.
Yeah.
The only thing they know is to be a slave.
Yeah, well, they're not even there yet right now. Right now, they're just running. They're running.
Some of these people that are chasing them are their friends, or they have gotten to know them. And so it puts them in a really bad situation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a seductive, difficult struggle, right? I mean, and they're right there. They're like, hey, you know, we're not going to go there yet about their reaction. I want to read you one quote from William Stringfellow. Attempted to put in all my arch enemies here. Jonathan hasn't jumped in and thrown the words in like IMF and WTO and INS and everything like that.
I'll just do one. The power of technology put to the wrong uses.
Okay.
You know, when you're facing something with an RPG in their hand, or even just a regular light weapon with automatic firing power, let alone a B-52 or a B-1 or something like that. I mean,
World Bank and the military industrial complex.
Technology combined with individual craziness is pretty frightening. The kill ratio in wars in the last century is 9 civilians for every soldier. And our Pentagon tells us, you know, we can't lose any more soldiers if we fight.
Okay.
But they don't talk about, they're not willing to talk about how many people we kill on the other end, and that's because it's the horrible power of the technology.
Yeah. And that's very seductive power.
Yeah, and it's invisible to us because all we see is the smart bomb's TV camera hitting its target and think, wow, that's cool.
Let me read to you a quote from William Stringfellow. He's a guy that I really love. He's written a book called An Ethic for Christians and Other Aliens in a Strange Land. And this is about principalities and powers. The powers as legion. According to the Bible, the principalities are legion in species, number, variety, and name. Designated by such multifarious titles as powers, virtues, thrones, authorities, dominions, demons, princes, strongholds, lords, angels, gods, elements, spirits. Sometimes the names of other creatures are appropriated for them, such as serpent, dragon, lion, beast. A similar practice survives today, of course, where animal symbols refer to nations or institutions. The bear is Russia. The tiger represents Princeton. The donkey, the Democratic Party. The pig, the police. Terms that characterize are frequently used biblically in naming the principalities. Words like tempter, mocker, foul spirit, destroyer, adversary, the enemy. And the privity of the principalities to the power of death incarnate, or their allegiance to death incarnate, is shown in mention of their agency to Beelzebub, or Satan, or the devil, or the Antichrist. The very array of names and titles in biblical usage for the principalities and powers is some indication of the scope and significance of the subject for human beings. And if some of these seem quaint, transposed into contemporary language, they lose quaintness and the principalities become recognizable and all too familiar. They include all institutions, all ideologies, all images, all movements, all causes, all corporations, all bureaucracies, all traditions, all methods and routines, all conglomerates, all races, all nations, all idols. Thus the Pentagon, or the Ford Motor Company, or Harvard University, or the Hudson Institute, or Consolidated Edison, or the Diners Club, or the Olympics, or the Methodist Church, or the Teamsters Union, are all principalities. For capitalism, Maoism, humanism, Mormonism, astrology, the Puritan work ethic, science and scientism, white supremacy, patriotism, plus many, many more. Sports, sex, any profession or discipline, technology, money, the family. Beyond any prospect of full enumeration, the principalities and powers are legion. Okay? I think that this notion of the powers is a very biblical notion, and I could give you many texts to support it, but here in Exodus we have enough, okay? So we're given a look into the complexity of the Jewish mind here, and you know, Hebrew scriptures, and told that we can expect that on the eve of liberation, the legion of forces are going to be on our tails, you know, at our heels, right? And remember, this particular event, this departure, is right at the moment of the Passover, right? Okay, Passover is the meal that marks the event where the forces, the principalities and powers are they open. I mean, there's an opening. There's a space created where the people can flee. Okay, remember that the equivalent of this is our Eucharist, or you know, the Lord's Supper, communion. You know, when at the table we take the body and the blood of Christ. This harkens back to, you know, the Passover event, which was a departure meal. It was a meal on the eve of a flight, and a flight wherein the people were hotly pursued. Okay, so how did the people respond in the face of this pursuit of the powers and principalities?
Fear.
Let's look carefully at what happens exactly. Could someone read verses 10 to 12?
As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert."
Okay, thank you. So what does this tell us about the human condition? How does liberation happen? We didn't look at the question of what the hardening of the Egyptians' heart and their refusal, I mean, their change of mind and their decision to pursue after they'd already just driven the people out, right? Let's look briefly at that before we look at the other question. What does that tell us about the nature of the forces of domination?
It's first is the herd instinct, I think about. Again, I think about how the familiar is more comfortable for them, so they stay stuck.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, there are benefits to this whole system of domination, right? Mm-hmm. Is what you're saying. Okay, so what are some of the benefits of the system of domination that would draw people, that would cause people to want to go back?
Knowledge of the future.
Security.
Security?
Yeah. But it's
security which includes knowledge of the future. Mm-hmm. You know,
the more lack of knowledge of the future.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, if you're on dish team and you're on dish team tomorrow, you're dish team the day after that, you know what tomorrow's bringing the day after that too. Yeah. I mean, if that's your role in life and you're enslaved to it, you don't have to make the decision about do I want to get up to the dishes or not. That's already been made for you. I guess is what I'm saying.
But coming outside of that security, as someone said, it being in that security,
if I don't know what's outside of security, lack of knowledge of what's on the outside.
On the outside, yeah, knowing what's in the inside, but not on the outside.
Right. And is that comfortable to not know what's on the outside?
No,
it's not.
There's a rigidity.
It's fearful. It's scary.
Okay.
There's a rigidity. And it looks like Pharaoh, there was that rigidity. We're going to keep it the same way, do it the same way. And that when the Israelites got out of that security, and sometimes in the rigidity, there's a bondage. You can't change. Well, you can't change for the better either.
Fear pursues you, though. Fear.
Okay.
It's after you.
Okay, so what does the fear and the anxiety cause you to do? I mean, how do we react when we're filled with anxiety and fear?
I'd rather just retreat back to what I'm used to.
Okay.
Let me just do what I think and leave me alone.
We constantly try to serve two masters.
Yeah, why did you bring me here? It's like they say.
Especially when there's work and there's money, there's, you know, that. I mean, the Israelites were kind of worried. And did you bring us out here to die?
Right.
You know, or we didn't have food and water and you sick.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Each one of those things that you look at, they all give you benefits.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's critical to look at the benefits squarely, you know. I mean, a lot of people, I deal with do a lot of one-on-one counseling with heroin addicts. And they tell me, you know, I say, well, what's up in your life? How's it going? You know, oh, bad, you know. I just got to stop using this heroin. I mean, it's bad. And I'll say, oh, really, you know, how long have you been using? Oh, you know, 12 years. And I'll say, well, what... It, but, you know, you see this as something that's really bad for you? And you'll say, oh, well, no kidding. I mean, look, you know, here I am in jail, and look, CPS has my kids and all this stuff, and it's bad, you know, and I just gotta kill it. I mean, I gotta get rid of it. And often I will say, well, no, you know, how have you benefited, you know, from heroin? And they'll say, well, what do you mean? I mean, I haven't benefited at all. There's no benefits. And I'll say, well, for 12 years you've been using this and you haven't had any benefits? And they'll say, well, no, it's just all bad. I mean, look, this is my 15th time in jail or whatever, my 25th time, or, you know, I've lost my family and I can't call no one wants to talk to me, my mom, my dad, my brothers. I mean, I'm disconnected. No one will receive my collect calls here in the jail. That just shows that everything's bad. And I'll say, okay, but how have you benefited? And it's a struggle for them, usually, to really be able to face Egypt in a way. Squarely and to look at it.
Where's the seduction? Why do you want to go back to it?
Yeah.
If it's all bad.
Yeah, and the more they talk and the more they feel freed and to be able to talk about the benefits, you know, then they begin to tell me, okay, well, yeah, it blows away my pain, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'll say, well, how do you feel before you take it and how do you feel after you take it? Well, before I feel anxious, I feel desperate, and after I feel like, you know, bliss, you know. And so, okay, well, that's a tremendous benefit. So you have been, you've experienced great pleasure as a result of this drug, and great benefit. Okay, so why would you ever want to stop? I mean, boy, that sounds great to me. I mean, you know, and really, every one of these powers and forces that are in our pursuit have a lot to offer. Okay, I mean, the gods that we are in allegiance to, or dominated by, it's a love affair. I mean, it's a relationship.
That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah. And with that, what you you know, to add something or to say something concerning that is that when I'm high, when I was high, I didn't see anything, I didn't feel anything. No reality was nowhere around. Mm-hmm. Then when the euphoria well, then I began mm-hmm. to see the pain. The depression, all of the emotions and all of that. And I was afraid, didn't know how to deal with it. So I resorted back to my drug of choice, which got me back into this, okay, I'm safe now, mm-hmm. you know. So, and then each time I got deeper and deeper into it. Mm-hmm. See, I got further and further into the wilderness. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have an open mind either. The Passover could have been jail. Mm-hmm. It was jail for me to mm-hmm. pass over. Mm-hmm. Okay, now you can make a decision now.
That's right.
Okay, and praying for open mind, say, okay, God, I know I'm comfortable back here on Hostel or wherever I was at. This is where I'm comfortable, but I know it's a better life for me. Mm-hmm. So, like you did for Israel, you led them in the way, lead me in the way. You know, so I can relate to this story a lot.
Wow. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, jail can be Egypt too, though. I mean, I deal with lots of men who, they try, you know, in jail, they come to their senses. Jail functions as a wake-up call. They seek after God and everything, and then they get back out, and they have all this debt, and they can't find work, and they don't have a driver's license, so they can't get to work, even if they have work, and they have all these probation, you know, appointments with a probation officer, and their partner doesn't want anything to do with them anymore, and they're feeling hurt about that. And all their friends are saying, hey, you know, why worry? You know, sell some drugs. Hey, get back into it. And so they're being pursued, and they get back into the crazy life, and they start to hate what's happening to themselves. Mm-hmm. And many of them tell me, look, I did this crime because I wanted to be back in here. You know, and I missed the Bible studies. Sometimes all they can say, you know, I got back into the You know, so it's pretty amazing. So there's a certain amount of protection.
Mom, we gotta get some mission churches going for you.
Okay, so, you know, we all have to face the seductions. We've looked at some of the seductions of the street. What about the seductions of Egypt for mainstream people? You know, I mean, some of us who are like, have mortgages and, you know, and IRAs and all kinds of things. What's that about? What's the
stock market?
Okay.
You have status. You have power and a position and a role to play.
Okay.
And if you go out in the wilderness, you lose that.
We have the illusion of control.
Lack of responsibility.
Lack of responsibility. Okay. So freedom is not such an easy thing. I mean, you know, to be in this place where you're right on the edge and you're not quite there. You're tasting the freedom, but you're seeing that all the forces are coming after you. I mean, you know, the anxiety is growing, right? Your anxiety level is just growing. What do you do?
Well,
And my buddies, they sell coke.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, they go. Is there any difference between shopping and selling coke?
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Are you sure? But the idea.
It doesn't matter who you're enriching, right?
The idea is to get the fix. The idea, the whole thing about shopping is the culture is telling us: if you go shop, you're going to get that happiness.
Yeah.
You buy this, you're going to have happiness. You buy the newer this, you're going to have more happiness.
Okay.
Very sad. Yeah.
Well, even a more basic
go ahead.
A more basic drug of choice is food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of us that battle with weight, you know, we think, I'm not going to eat that ice cream. I'm not going to eat that ice cream. And then we eat that ice cream, and then we feel bad about eating that ice cream, and then we got to eat more ice cream because we feel bad. Just
like So how do we deal with anxiety? It's all about anxiety, right? I mean, here we're brought to a point. Right on the edge of the wilderness is a place of total anxiety, where all of the things, we're being pursued, and that strikes fear in our bones, okay? And we think of all the things, all the ways that we've dealt with our anxiety in the past, you know, whether it's shopping, or whether it's eating, or whether it's, you know, using drugs, or whether it's sexual addictions, or whether it's, you know, reading. I mean, you know, it could be anything. Whether it's, maybe it's worship, you know. Is it the opiate of the people?
I think, I was just going to say that to the church could be a principality, because sometimes in response to the other things, you fly the other way.
Yeah.
And when I was younger, in particular, it was easier for me because I saw less of the shades of gray. And it was way easier to be black or white than to not have to think that the church was telling you what was right and what was wrong, and to not have to make any discernment choices that may or may not be right. Discernment's way harder than taking a party line.
Sure. When we get anxious in the church and we say, what can I do? What happens usually? In many churches that I've been part of, you get put on a committee. Okay? So committee work is a way to deal with our anxiety. But is it just another way to go back to Egypt?
Yeah.
Is it just another way to have all of our energies just sucked away from any kind of relevance in the world?
Sometimes.
Sometimes, but not always.
Yeah, I mean, we're... you know, because some of these institutions are there for very good reasons.
Okay, but are we to hope in institutions as that which no. saves?
Well, no.
You know, what does Exodus tell us?
Institutions are organizations of people. And you all, a lot of you here who are also pointing out that we have rigid institutions that can serve wrong purposes are part of other institutions that are working very hard to serve right purposes. So the fact that you're on a committee is not in and of itself a bad thing.
Right.
You know, it's the committee is a group of people with a commitment to get something done.
Sure. Ideally speaking, but in many cases, committees become, you know, just our different ways, even going out and doing service. You know, oftentimes our mission is driven by anxiety, and it's not really driven by freedom and by discernment, by this narrower way of discernment. And so we find ourselves not always satisfied by our work, which we call ministry. You know, I mean, I have years of ministry, and some of it has been very unsatisfying. I mean, I find it takes tremendous discernment to know what, you know, where, how to avoid, I guess, the enslavements of institutional Christianity. But anyway, let's look
can
at the
I,
next.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
You know, if I look at all this and hearing some of those talks yesterday, it's depressing. But I look at the scripture and it says, but God.
Okay, but let's look. Yeah,
God made the promise. Mm-hmm. And God fulfilled his word. And all the fear and the anxiety and the new situations and all that, because God made a promise. He took them out of all those terrible things. It wasn't easy. It wasn't perfect. But for God. And I mean, that's the key.
Well, let's look at that. Let's read 14, chapter 14, verses 13 to 14. Okay. I think sometimes we jump too quickly to the promise and to the liberation and to the salvation, and we don't talk enough about what really we're up against, okay? So I've been letting us dwell here a little bit. Okay, let's go there now though, okay? We only have 7 more minutes, so if we need to. Can someone read verses 13 and 14?
But Moses said to the people, do not be afraid, stand firm, and see the deliverance that the Lord will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see never again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to keep still.
Okay. See, there's the word right there.
Yeah.
It's at the very heart of this whole story. Okay. If there's any before and after of this story, it is this word.
Right.
Almost more than the Passover itself, it is this very word. Post-Passover, you know, post-Lord's Supper, you know, when the rubber is really meeting the road for the believing community, it's at this point that Moses is called, you know, be still. The Lord will fight for you. Okay? That's when it comes. Okay? So finding calmness and peace in the midst of this totally scary, precarious place on the edge of freedom is what it's all about, right?
The tabernacling of the Lord comes when we're in our weakness. When we recognize our weakness. Have you read Powers, Weakness, and the Tabernacling of God?
Oh yeah, I have. It's a wonderful book by Marmadon. Yeah. So,
And also in these two verses, what I got is that Moses is saying to the people, you know, you have to surrender to God. You know, you can't do it, Michelle. You know, but you can be still, you know, and ask God to guide you, because that's who God is.
Okay, but this looks crazy. Okay, it looks crazy because look, you're sitting here. The people are all right here. Okay, and they're all just, the armies are coming at them. And it just looks like a no exit situation. It is a no exit situation, humanly speaking, right? I mean, they're hemmed in, they're penned against the sea. Okay, so this is, and it's interesting, one thing I forgot to point out in the text is that it says that when the people went out, they went out armed. Okay? But that's just, that little detail is never pursued again by the narrator. You know, I mean, it doesn't say that the people suddenly pulled out their Uzis, you know, and kind of lined up and dug some trenches and got ready for a battle at all. It's more like they're just terrorized, right? Okay? And it's at that moment that Moses comes in. And here, this is saying something. This is where Exodus's view of how salvation occurs is you know, needs to be heard loud and clear. How does salvation happen, according to Exodus, up to this point? Does it happen through reforming of the powers and principalities? No. Does it happen through the people's choice?
Yes.
No.
The people choosing to surrender.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Choosing to say, okay, I'm there. I got to be still because God got me. He's coming in here.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a choice.
Okay. So there is something about, I mean, otherwise there wouldn't be any kind of a call, okay, to be still, right? And to know that the Lord will fight for you. I mean, there is maybe a moment of just being able to, but what is that about then? What is the choice?
Having faith.
Faith? Okay. Faith in what? Faith in what?
Faith in God's promise.
Believing in His Word.
You know, this sounds a lot like the 12th first step, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What is the first step? What is the first step?
Powerlessness.
Realize that you're powerless to control your addiction, that you are a slave, and what?
Your life is unmanageable.
And your life is unmanageable. Okay, what's the second step?
Can we believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity?
Wow, okay. So boy, Exodus seems like it's kind of like a...
Number 3 is real strong.
Like an AA. What's that? I missed
that.
The third step is a powerful decision. Make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand.
Okay. Amen. One thing we don't know, okay, this is one word against decision theology and AA maybe too, is that there's no, Exodus doesn't make a big deal about that part of it. They don't say, oh yeah, and all the people, they just got down on their knees and they said, okay, Lord, yeah, we trust you and here it is. It doesn't, things are happening too quick. We just hear the call to do that. But then what happens? Let's read the next section.
Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water, so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all of his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen.
Keep going.
Then the angel of God, who had been traveling in front of Israel's army, withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to the one side and light to the other side, so that neither went near the other all night long. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. Mm-hmm. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground, mm-hmm. with a wall of water on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. During the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. Mm-hmm. He made the wheels of their chariots come off so that they had difficulty driving. And the Egyptians said, let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. Continue?
Okay. Yeah, keep going all the way to 31.
Okay. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak, the sea went back into its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground, with a wall of water on their right and on their left. That day the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. And when the Israelites saw the great power of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in Him and in Moses, His servant.
Okay. Okay. What did the people have to do in order to get saved?
Nothing.
Action.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Trust.
They have to go.
Now we have two. What's that?
It's interesting. The sea is the way of salvation and the way of destruction. Mm-hmm. And the baptism in our faith. brings it toward
the sea. The sea is kind of a metaphor for baptism. You know, it's interesting. Baptism and the Lord's Supper, you know, sometimes we stop there in our theology. Okay, that's like the high point, okay? But remember, the Eucharistic meal is what happens immediately after Jesus' Last Supper. Between the table and the resurrection is the cross, okay? Okay, and everyone scatters, right? All of his disciples scatter. I mean, after the meal, you have the one who betrays, and you have the one who denies, and you have the rest that run, okay? And then you have the cross, okay? So you have the same theology. I mean, if you look at the question of how does salvation happen? I think this text is pretty loud and clear. It's saying that it happens not through human, you know, through human volition, nor through the principalities and powers reforming themselves and changing, but it happens through God. You know, God is the one who saves.
Well, he talks about the fear and the trust as an after death.
Yeah. Exactly. So belief happens in response to salvation. This is a big theological question. Like, how does faith happen? Is it that the Israelites really did believe? I mean, we know they cried out to the Lord. Earlier in the text, it says that they cried out to the Lord, but then it says they turned to Moses and said, "Why did you bring us here to die in the wilderness?" You know, so they cried out almost like, you know, pray and then pass the ammunition. What's that song? Forget that.
Praise the Lord,
pass the ammunition, right? You know, it's like God helps those who help themselves. I mean, that's kind of what they're doing in a way, right? But, so anyway, one thing we need to remember is that baptism too. What is baptism? Jesus, what happens immediately after Jesus' baptism?
Temptation.
The Spirit drives him into the wilderness, okay, to be tempted by the devil. Okay. One of the problems that I see in the jail, we have a lot of churches that go in there and say, accept Jesus and everything's going to be okay. No more problems, you know, your addiction's going to go away. I was a heroin addict and I accepted Jesus and it's all gone. Okay, well, that's not what I see. You know, what I see, and I don't know what you all see, but it's a struggle. It's a struggle. You know, it's a constant struggle, and that's what this wilderness, all these wilderness stories are about. It's just about how life towards the promised land is a life of constant temptation. You know, where we're being assaulted by the forces of evil. But God is there for us, right? Before us, behind us, and ahead of us. And anyway, we're out of time.